There's a lot that's in short supply right now, but jobs aren't one of them. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday, April 21st. Good to have you with us. We usually end the show with a little economic context, but I think that's a good place to start today, because this time 2 years ago, mid-April 2020, more than 4.4 million Americans filed for first-time unemployment benefits in a single week, almost 4.5 million, seasonally adjusted. That's the context for this. In the week that ended April 16th of this year, the number of new jobless claims was just 184,000. The four-week moving average is even lower. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has more now on how far the job market has come and where it might be headed.
Even before the pandemic, it was rare for first-time jobless claims to fall consistently below 200,000 week after week. But that's where we are, says Andrew Stettner at the Century Foundation.
It's absolutely great news that workers are not being forced to apply for unemployment benefits. The job market is strong. People are very confident about their ability to find a job quickly if they lose a job.
And not that many workers are losing their jobs, says Andy Challenger at outplacement firm Challenger Gray and Christmas.
Layoffs are at historic lows. Near record highs in job openings across the country. Employers are hanging on to their employees at any cost.
By hiking wages and offering show up for your first day of work bonuses, especially for high demand service jobs.
There's just intense competition for those workers willing to come in and work in-person jobs. And so companies are poaching them back and forth from each other.
There are nearly 2 million people who were working before the pandemic but aren't now. That includes a lot of parents, especially mothers of young children. One reason they're on the sidelines, there aren't enough childcare slots or enough teachers. Abby Copeman-Pettig at UC Berkeley says median pay is around $28,000 a year, and most childcare centers can't afford to pay more.
It's an issue of competition. You know, Starbucks, Target, places like that are able to offer $15 an hour, $17 an hour, tuition, benefits.
There is a risk this whole tight labor market, low unemployment situation could unravel, says Richard Walquist at the American Staffing Association.
We're in a completely uncharted territory, both in terms of fiscal monetary policy and then the geopolitical issues.
But he says so far, consumer demand and employer demand for workers show no sign of slowing down. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, all downhill for the major indices. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Earlier this week, natural gas prices in the U.S. rose to their highest level since 2008, around the time of the shale boom. That's because many Western nations are no longer buying oil and gas from Russia because of its invasion of Ukraine. The price of gas reached just over $8 per million British thermal units, as gas is measured, BTUs. Today, that price is down a bit, but still about double what it was this time last year. And some analysts are asking if the U.S. should be holding on to more of the liquefied natural gas that it's been exporting to other countries to keep down energy costs at home. Marketplace's Andy Euler has that one.
The U.S. is sending record amounts of liquefied natural gas overseas. Trey Cowan at the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis says that's because U.S. producers want to cash in. The boycott of Russian gas by many nations has pushed up prices because a chunk of supply has disappeared.
You've got more bidders for the commodity, in this case, LNG. You've got more bidders for it, and that drives up the price.
And it drives up the price of natural gas in the U.S. too. Now, natural gas isn't quite a global commodity like oil is, but more and more we're seeing that international prices affect what we pay here. And Anna Mikuska at Rice University says we're also not just sending liquefied gas overseas.
Everybody keeps thinking about LNG exports, but we are actually exporting quite a lot of gas via pipeline, mostly to Mexico.
Those export contracts are often in 20-year increments, so beyond a natural disaster, it's tough for a natural gas producer to just stop exporting and keep more gas at home to drive down the price. Now, a big part of the problem here is that supply isn't reacting to $100 oil like it has in the past. Stuart Glickman is an equity analyst at CFRA. He says investors are more geared for short-term returns now, and there are other factors preventing oil companies from ramping up production quickly, too.
Pipe is more expensive and harder to come by. Steel is more expensive. Labor is harder to find.
And beyond supply constraints, demand is different now, too. In the past, U.S. power plants would often switch to burning coal when the price of natural gas reached about $3.50. Robert Johnston at Columbia says that's not happening these days for a couple of reasons.
One is that we have shut in a fair amount of coal-fired power plants. The other is that coal is also in short supply and a high price as well. So the economics of switching from gas to coal have not been that great either.
That's beside the environmental concerns of burning coal as well. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
China's largest city and financial capital, Shanghai, city of 25 million, is now entering its fourth week of a strict COVID lockdown. And many are going hungry as disruptions to trucking and logistics have cut off food supplies. As our China correspondent Jennifer Pack has reported, for all those stuck at home, it's been tough to order anything from the usual e-commerce apps. She sent us this update on her own search for food over the past week.
I started last weekend with 60 eggs, a gallon of cooking oil, and a dwindling vegetable supply for two. When my community bulk buying group found handmade buns locally, we doubled the order, 20 with pork and preserved vegetable filling for $17.50. That same day, a meat contact came through. Beef shank and brisket, 9 pounds for nearly $70. Over a 24-hour period, we received handouts of vegetables and cuts of meat we've never used before, from my district, the city, and from my boyfriend's company. On Sunday, something different, gourmet bread. I split a box with our neighbor, which still cost me $15, and all I wanted was the loaf of whole wheat, which turned out slightly stale. The real luxuries come from back channels, one cappuccino for 2 cups of cooking oil. It took 3 weeks to finally land a tiny bottle of soy sauce in a government handout, but a friend said, be careful. That brand has had recalls before. In Shanghai, under lockdown, I'm Jennifer Pack for Marketplace.
The mask mandate on airplanes and other public transportation is up in the air. Yesterday, the Justice Department appealed a judge's decision to lift the mandate earlier this week. Also yesterday, the Federal Aviation Administration said its zero-tolerance policy for unruly airline passengers will become permanent. Many of the record number of incidents of bad behavior in the past couple of years have been aimed at the flight attendants tasked with enforcing mask wearing. This is far from the first hardship flight attendants have faced on the job, and that history is the subject of The Great Stewardess Rebellion, a new book by Nell McShane Wolfhart about how women flight attendants in the 1960s and 70s fought to change their industry. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Amy. Happy to be here.
So I think people have a vague idea that the job of flight attendant has changed a lot over the years and used to be, you know, highly gendered. But just reading this book, it's kind of a staggering reminder of just how sexist this workplace was. What did it take to be a stewardess in the 1960s?
Well, back in the 1960s, even just to get the job, you had to meet a number of what we would consider now bizarre requirements. You had to be extremely thin, you had to meet certain weight limits, and if you gained a few pounds, you could be pulled off the flight. You couldn't wear glasses, you couldn't be married, You couldn't be pregnant or have kids, and you had to be generally in your late teens or early 20s, because when you turned 32, you would be fired.
Okay, so I'm out. I've been out for some time.
Me too.
But given all that and the pretty low pay, how did airlines manage to get women to want these jobs?
It's actually amazing. When you look at the ads that were recruiting stewardesses back in the 60s, they sell this extremely glamorous life. And I think that's even what we think of now when we think about the golden age of travel, you know, Don Draper and cocktails in first class. You know, the allure of the stewardess was so powerful. Everyone just thought of her as this glamorous, beautiful woman that it was a really aspirational job.
It's interesting, though, those same ads really sexualized stewardesses and became a big point of contention for the union groups that eventually overturned a lot of these rules. How did the ads kind of backfire on the industry?
Well, the ads backfired in a way in that they got bad publicity when the stewardesses got mad about them, but they really worked for the industry in that they sold a lot of airplane tickets. I think the most famous ad was an ad that National Airlines ran in the early 70s with a picture of like a smiling white young woman looking right at the camera. And the tagline was, "I'm Linda, fly me." And they ran this huge campaign that was all like, "I'm Cheryl, fly me," all using photos of real stewardesses. And although ads up to that point had definitely sexualized the stewardesses, the Fly Me campaign was the one that really got them out on the streets protesting. And their signs read, "Go fly yourself," which is one of my favorites.
I think I want to use that. As you describe so powerfully in the book, stewardesses weren't just facing sexism in the cabin, but in the union that was supposed to be fighting for them. And eventually they created their own union and fought against many of these sexist policies successfully. How did that change the industry and the job?
Well, like we described, there was sort of this very sexist attitude towards women. And in the 60s and into the 70s, the feminist movement, you know, was really taking off. And I think the difference between what these women could see happening in the streets and the changes they could see happening in the rest of the world and the sort of time warp that they entered when they stepped into the airplane cabin and they had to wear a girdle and, you know, get weighed before they got on the plane. Those were things that really started to grate on them. It was that contrast. And it was a combination of, yeah, their unions and lawsuits and complaints with the EEOC that finally brought about these changes. But it was, an uphill slog all the way, and it took many years.
It's interesting. You were, I imagine, writing this book, or at least finishing it, during a time of massive upheaval in the travel industry during the COVID-19 pandemic, and at a time when flight attendants have been in the news and facing, you know, extreme behavior from passengers. How did this history kind of affect how you thought about the moment now for these women and men who work as flight attendants?
I think a lot of the issues that we're seeing right now in the airplane cabin, there's really a through line from what was happening back in the 60s and 70s, the lack of respect towards flight attendants. And I think that's something that has been sort of emphasized by these, you know, ridiculous uniforms that airplanes used to make the stewardesses wear, like, you know, hot pants and go-go boots. It was almost like a deliberate, you know, way to make people take stewardesses less seriously. And I think that, like, you really can trace that up to now, in which, you know, passengers don't feel like they have to pay attention to the flight attendants and they don't have to do what they say, even though really those flight attendants are there to make sure that, you know, everyone gets off the plane alive and that everything goes okay. But I do think there are some lessons that flight attendants of today can learn from the way that flight attendants back in the 60s and 70s managed to make change. And one of those, of course, is through their union.
Nell McShane-Wolfhart is author of The Great Stewardess Rebellion. Fascinating story. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thanks so much, Amy. This is really fun.
Coming up.
Life is too short. They want to make the most of it when they can.
It certainly is. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 368 points, 1% to finish at 34,792. The NASDAQ lost 278 points, 2% there to end at 13,174. And the S&P 500 subtracted 65 points, 1.4% to land at 43.93. Andy Uhler talked about the natural gas market and LNG exports. So looking down the pipeline at companies in that business, ExxonMobil sputtered down 1%. Chevron burned off more than 4.5%. More streaming struggles. CNN says it will shut down its new streaming service, CNN Plus, only a month after it launched. CNN parent company Warner Brothers Discovery clicked down 6.7%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas. Loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. It's college decision season, and more students are making decisions this year. The number of applicants is up about 6% from last year, according to the nonprofit Common App. One thing that means is that the college housing crunch is probably going to get crunchier. Sensing a good opportunity, the investment firm Blackstone said this week that it's buying American Campus Communities, the country's largest developer, owner, and manager of student housing, for about $13 billion. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has this report on the state of the student housing market.
An investment in student housing could be seen as a bet that teenagers are still going to want a classic college experience.
Having that rite of passage, this is something that families really, really, really want to give their children.
Robert Bronstein is president and co-founder of the Cyan Group. It's a big owner and operator of off-campus student housing in the U.S. And he says going to college is not just about getting the degree.
They're sending them to a college campus for all the social and networking and other benefits that exist by living amongst 30,000 other 18 to 24-year-olds at really formative years.
Student housing has historically been considered resilient, no matter what the economy is doing. Alan Peterson is an analyst at the real estate research firm Green Street.
Many individuals, if they're out of a job or if the economy kind of comes to the skids, people will go back to school or people will be demanding more education.
Even during the pandemic, many people remained in student housing, though they were going to class online. Here's Robert Bronstein of Cyan Group again.
It was like FOMO took over. My parents want me to stay at home, but look, on Instagram, everyone's there.
And the there can be pretty nice. Timothy S. Bradley is the owner and founder of TSB Capital Advisors. It advised Blackstone on its purchase of American Campus Communities. He says there have been amenities wars between different buildings.
Who could have the biggest pool? Who has the pool on the rooftop? Who has a fitness center looking at the pool? Tanning beds, saunas, computer rooms, study rooms.
Bradley points out another attraction of investing in student housing is that most of the time, parents are required to guarantee the rent. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Remember the big pivot early in the pandemic when consumer-facing food businesses had to figure out how to be not quite so consumer-facing? Restaurants, wholesalers, grocery stores all had to find new ways to keep people fed and keep their businesses alive. And that meant a lot of shipping and delivery. Now, though, things have changed again. The BBC's Victoria Craig checked back in with some businesses across the UK to see how they're doing in year three of this pandemic.
At a refrigerated warehouse on a southeast London industrial estate, this is the sound of change. Wholesale food supplier Smith & Brock is adapting its pandemic-proofed business model for the third time.
We started a home delivery business, which kind of saved our bacon in 2020. And we're now looking at expanding the wholesale business, moving into new premises.
That's Nick Fowler, one of the company's co-owners. When the pandemic first forced people into lockdown 2 years ago, business dried up overnight. With no hotels, restaurants, or events to supply, Smith & Brock packed boxes full of fresh produce and delivered them to people all across London. Then they expanded, partnering with big-name restaurants to offer more customized at-home food experiences. Fowler and his team called the project Knock Knock, and it became a strand of the business that, a year ago, they intended to make permanent. But now...
we're scaling it back just because the demand from lockdown and people going back to restaurants and usual ways of procuring their food has changed, so it's just not really commercially viable anymore.
This week, Smith & Brock delivered its last Knock Knock box because, as Fowler said in a letter to customers, they, quote, don't have the deep pockets of private equity, just the back pocket of his and co-founder Joe's ripped jeans. What's more, with the weather getting warmer and COVID restrictions completely rolled back in the UK, people are itching to get back to the easygoing ways of pre-pandemic life.
People are wanting to go out more than they did pre-pandemic, despite cases still being high.
Darren Morgan is the director of economic statistics at the UK's Office for National Statistics. He and his team have crunched payment card data and restaurant reservations from OpenTable. Aggregate spending, their figures show, was up 6% last week from pre-pandemic levels, while restaurant bookings soared 22% during the same period.
What people are telling us is perhaps they reflected during the pandemic, you know, life is too short. They want to make the most of it when they can in terms of being able to go out and eat, and they've missed it.
It's a trend on full display in East London's Shoreditch neighborhood. Diners at the Mumbai-style Indian restaurant Dishoom are sipping chai, digging into bowls full of black dal, and plates of chicken smothered in a rich red curry sauce. Kavi Takarar is the chain's co-founder.
One thing that we're really focused on is creating beautiful restaurant spaces, great experiences for our team, great experiences for our guests. And when the pandemic hit, obviously it was a complete change in events.
Like so many other restaurants, Dishoom quickly pivoted to at-home deliveries at the start of the pandemic, offering fan favorites like the bacon naan roll.
In the kit, you're going to get some of this fantastic bacon,
which Takarar demonstrated how to make in a step-by-step video online. The offerings were so popular among customers across the UK that in addition to meal kits, Dishoom also launched hot food delivery in several cities. And it expanded its at-home range to include jarred sauces and jams, chai, and even cocktails. Now, at a time when many restaurants are taking away their pandemic-era at-home offerings, Dishoom is moving full steam ahead in the opposite direction.
The people that buy our breakfast kits are now trying our grill kits, or trying our feast kits, or trying our biryani kits. I think as a broader market, meal kits probably have come down. But if I look at the business as a whole, it will, as we add new products and new kits, continue to grow, because I think people are interested in different routines in their own lives.
While Dishoom keeps adding, Smith & Brock's Fowler says his equation isn't all subtraction.
My dad, he was a retail businessman, so he had shops and market stalls and greengrocers and floristry. So it was always something we kind of wanted to do.
And in November, Fowler and his team made the dream a reality, opening the company's first bricks-and-mortar store called The Market. It offers the same restaurant-quality produce and meat delivery customers came to enjoy during lockdown. Another pivot that proves, yet again, for consumer-facing food businesses, the only constant in a pandemic is change. In London, I'm the BBC's Victoria Craig for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out, you may not have heard of the Reedy Creek Improvement District. I hadn't, even though I've been there a few times. That's the name of a special tax district created more than 50 years ago for a certain theme park you probably have heard of, Walt Disney World. Today, the Florida House voted to revoke Disney World's self-governing status after a state Senate vote yesterday. Republican Governor Ron DeSantis is expected to sign the measure in retaliation for Disney's stand against Florida's so-called Don't Say Gay education law, which prohibits classroom discussion of sexual orientation and gender identity in early grades. After pressure from its employees, Disney condemned that law and said it would pause all political donations in the state. In the 2020 cycle, Politico says, Disney's donations to Florida candidates totaled $4.8 million. Okay, here's your official moment of economic context. A short one today, just to add that a half a point interest rate hike at the next Fed meeting in a few weeks is looking ever more likely. At a roundtable today, Fed Chair Jerome Powell said this.
It is appropriate, in my view, to be moving a little more quickly.
More quickly, that is, than in previous tightening cycles. Mark your calendars. The next FOMC meeting is May 3rd and 4th. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Peter, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Amy Scott. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.